out there who are concerned about your weight, and we are legion. This is a big question. Are all calories equal?
A calorie is a calorie when it comes to weight. The body really doesn't care where the calories come from. But if you're worried about your health, or you care about your health, you care a lot about where the calories come from.
That's nutrition professor Marion Nessel. We talked to her about her book, Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. We also hear our 2006 interview with food psychologist Brian Wanzink. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Low fat, high fat, low carbs, high carbs, the Twinkies diet, the Atkins diet, and the list goes on. It seems everybody has a magic diet to melt off the pounds of the growing legions of the overweight. Meanwhile, the obesity epidemic continues to fatten. My guest, nutrition professor Marion Nessel, goes back to basics in the book she co-authored with Malda Nesheim, Why Calories Count. Nessel says losing weight is all about taking in fewer calories than we expend. It's that simple. Or is it? We have a hard time understanding calories because they can't be seen, smelled, or tasted. We can gulp down as many as 900 of them in a mocha latte and not feel full at all. Why Calories Count helps the reader understand how calories work, as well as the political and social forces that are creating an eat-more environment at the same time as billions suffer from food insecurity. And surprisingly, Wall Street's drive for ever more short-term profits plays a key role. I spoke with Marion Nessel in June, right around the time the Farm Bill was being discussed in the House of Representatives. Marion Nessel, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, in one of the points that you repeat a lot in this book, Why Calories Count, is that if you want to lose weight, you have to eat less, exercise more, or both. In other words, a calorie is a calorie, no matter what it's made of. But a lot of diets differentiate between calories from fat and calories from protein and carbs. Talk a little bit about why is a calorie just a calorie?
Well, you have to talk about two different concepts at the same time. A calorie is a calorie when it comes to weight. The body really doesn't care where the calories come from. But if you're worried about your health, or you care about your health, you care a lot about where the calories come from. And if you're trying to manage a weight problem, which a lot of people are because there's so much food around, then it's much, much easier to manage your weight problem if you eat healthfully.
So there is a connection, managing your weight problem and eating healthfully.
Oh, absolutely. It's much easier to manage your weight if you're eating fruits and vegetables and things that don't have huge concentrated sources of calories. So if you follow dietary recommendations and don't eat too much, you'll do fine. You can lose weight on any kind of diet, no matter how horrible or stupid it is. But that's not going to help your health. You want to promote your health at the same time that you're managing your weight. And that means eating healthfully. Sorry, no easy way out of that one.
Now, you do talk about nutrient-dense foods and calorie-dense foods. Sometimes they're the same, though. I mean, there are foods that are high in fat, like nuts, for example, that are also very nutrient-dense. I mean, if you want to lose weight, is it okay to eat nuts?
Of course it is. You could lose weight eating nothing but nuts if you reduced your calorie intake below expenditure. Some professor proved that with the Twinkie diet. He ate nothing but Twinkies for a month and lost 25 pounds. Anybody could do that eating 800 calories a day as he was.
But you wouldn't be very satisfied.
Well, I don't know whether he was trying to satisfy or prove a point. I don't really know why he did that. That doesn't seem like a very good long-term strategy for anything. But he lost weight, and anybody would lose weight eating 800 calories a day. You could eat 800 calories of chocolate bars. You could eat 800 calories of avocados. You could eat 800 calories of nuts. You'd lose weight.
But if you wanted to eat avocados, say, and also be satiated, avocados are a perfect example. It's very high in fat, high in calories, and yet healthy as well. So what guide would you give to somebody who wanted to lose weight in regards to, well, I'm thinking also of the Mediterranean diet, which is supposed to be so healthy for you, but it's pretty high in fat.
Well, it's relatively high in fat, and avocados don't have more calories than a Big Mac or any other kind of fast food. If you want to lose weight, and you have to reduce your calorie intake below expenditure. It's not any more complicated than that. But what makes it complicated is it's impossible to tell the number of calories in food because you can't guess unless you weigh every single thing you're eating and know every single ingredient and look it up in tables, which, believe me, is incredibly boring to do. So you can't guess what you don't know the calories in what you're eating, and you don't know how many calories you need. So you're working in an unknown situation, and the only way that you can tell whether you're eating the right number of calories is by measuring your weight on a scale at regular intervals. If your weight is staying the same, relax, enjoy it, you're doing fine. If your weight is going up, you've got to cut back.
Now, talking about how many calories you need, I mean, there are recommendations. How did the U.S. arrive at the recommendations of that it has, it's roughly 2,000 calories a day?
Oh, they made it up. That's a made-up number. And I know that sounds incredible, but if you go and read the FDA's discussion of where that 2,000-calorie figure comes from, it comes from survey data on the number of calories that people were eating in the 1960s and 70s. And that number came out on average, men and women, everybody, to be 2,350 calories on average. So 350 calories more than 2,000. And the FDA wanted to use 2350 as a baseline. And everybody who read that said, that's crazy. That's going to encourage people to eat more. And besides, it's an impossible number to deal with. Americans don't carry calculators around with them and don't know how to do division in their heads. Why don't you make it 2,000? It's good. It's a good enough number. And it's certainly about what a lot of women eat on a daily basis. And then it'll be much easier to compare things on food labels because people can kind of handle 2,000 calories as a baseline. 2,350 is out of the question.
Mm. You talk about how people don't know how many calories are in their food. I'm staying here now in New York State, and in a lot of restaurants or chain restaurants, you go in and you'll see the number of calories next to the dishes that they have. And they're jaw-droppingly large.
That's exactly the way I would put it. Absolutely jaw-dropping. You have no idea. When calorie labeling started in New York City, I went around to all of the fast food places on 8th Street, which is near where I live. And I just went from one to the other, and jaw-dropping is exactly the way I would have put it. I remember seeing a blueberry pomegranate smoothie that had 1,200 calories. You know, that's half of a day's calorie intake for somebody like me. Or there was a pizza for one at one of the fast food places that was 2,200 calories. I couldn't understand how it could have 2,200 calories, except that it was dripping in olive oil, and it had a very, very thick crust and a lot of cheese on it.
Yeah, I mean, simple sandwiches seem to be like 1,800 calories.
Yes, astounding numbers.
Yeah, and so one thing,
but you have to look at them. They don't do any good unless you look at those numbers.
Well, that was my next point. It seems that people, you know, I've turned on my heel and walked out of those restaurants because there's nothing I can eat. I mean, I'm not going to eat something that has that many calories.
And you're not going to buy the whole thing, because if you do, you're going to be tempted to eat it all.
Oh, absolutely. There's no way I can't finish something that's in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
So how come it's not working?
It's working for you.
Yeah, for me
It's working for me. It's working for people who look at the calories. They go into these places and see that a muffin is 500 or 600 calories, and they either don't buy it or they cut it in half and share it with a friend.
But it's not working for most people. Most people aren't paying any attention to them. What do you make of that?
Well, they have to be, I suppose, educated to look at them, and there needs to be an enormous campaign. I mean, right now, the calorie labeling is in limbo because national calorie labeling was signed into law in the Health Care Reform Act a couple of years ago. And with the Health Care Reform Act under attack, it's not clear what's going to happen with calorie labeling. And the FDA has not issued the regulations that it's supposed to have issued this year. They're still out for comment, and they're still being argued about because the FDA is giving a lot of passes to things like movie theaters and other places where I think calorie labeling is really important. Movie theaters are amazing.
Right. Movie theaters, that's where you get those jumbo buckets of 64-ounce sodas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, talking about 64-ounce sodas, I mean, here was a case in point. You talk about a class that you went to in the book.
I got somebody else to do this. The instructor for our introductory nutrition class, Lisa Young, was my former doctoral student, and I asked her if she would do us a favor and ask her class how many calories were in an 8-ounce soda, and to give them a quiz early on in the semester, and then how many calories were in a 64-ounce double gulp. And we didn't expect that beginning students would know how many calories were in an 8-ounce soda. It happens to be 100, but we didn't really expect them to know that. But we absolutely expected them to be able to multiply by 8. 64 is 8 times 8. And we were absolutely floored when she came back and said, "You're not going to believe this." She said the average multiplier was 3, not 8. So that if they said that it was 100 calories in an 8-ounce soda, they said that the 64-ounce soda had 300. I said, "Well, that's kind of amazing. You've got to go back and ask them how come. Even beginning students can multiply by 8. They really can. They're not that mathematically challenged." And so she did. She went back to the class and said, "Okay, guys, how come?" And they said, "800 calories in a soda is impossible. It's just not possible. It doesn't say 800 calories on the label. Drinking a big soda doesn't make us feel full. It's not possible." Unfortunately, it is. It's just not intuitively obvious.
So that's the connection. People think that something that's going to make them full is going to have a lot of calories, or vice versa.
Yeah, maybe that's one part of it. And the other is that they think that if it comes in a container, it has 100 calories. I mean, if I had one thing that I could teach everybody, it would be that larger portions have more calories. It's not intuitively obvious.
Mm. Well, you point out in the book numerous times in Why Calories Count, and if you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Marion Nessel, who wrote the book with Malden Nesheim. Marion, you point out many times in the book that if you want to do one thing to decrease your weight, don't drink your calories.
Yeah, that's a pretty good place to start, because those calories are calories with no nutritional value, and they're not computed. Somehow, the calories that come in liquid form are not computed by the body as food. So they kind of bypass the regulatory systems that make you feel full and make you feel not hungry anymore. So it's a really good place. It's a really good starting place. And it's one of the reasons why I think Mayor Bloomberg's idea to restrict the sizes of sodas sold in a lot of places in New York to 16 ounces makes sense.
Well, he's getting a huge amount of pushback.
He sure is.
Yeah.
Why? I mean,
why do you think he's getting that?
Well, he's getting it because people think this is a level of government intrusion into their personal lives that they find intolerable. I think it's really interesting, and I've been watching the whole debate with great fascination. One of the things that the city health department shows is early advertisement for Coca-Cola that says that 16 ounces serves 3. I thought that was kind of amazing. That was back in the day when sodas were 6.5 ounces.
And I remember those days.
Now, if sodas were 6.5 ounces, nobody would be the slightest bit concerned about them. Mm-hmm. But they're not 6.5 ounces. The default soda size in a vending machine is 20 ounces. And if I had one thing to teach, it would be that a 20-ounce soda has more calories than a 6.5-ounce soda, or even an 8-ounce soda. So this seems like a completely reasonable thing to do to me. To me, it seems completely reasonable. One of the difficulties with it is that the soda industry prices the smaller sodas at a higher level than it prices the big ones on a per-ounce basis. So if you buy 8-ounce cans of soda, you're paying a lot more for them on a volume basis than you are if you buy a 2-liter or 2-quart bottle, and that's a real disincentive to buy small portions. I think smaller portions should be priced lower than big portions. That would be a real incentive to people to consume less. And that's what you want people to do. But the problem is that eating less is very, very bad for business.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, you would think that if they're charging more for the smaller bottles, and the smaller bottles are the ones that are going to be now drunk more, wouldn't the soda companies be pushing Bloomberg's nanny state?
I think they see this as a first step in a much more nefarious kind of government intervention. I don't know. I mean, let's see what happens with it. I think it's a really interesting idea, and I can think of lots of reasons why it's a good idea. Because people, it's just what we were talking about before, we eat what's in front of us. And if we're served a 16-ounce soda, we're going to consume 16 ounces. If we're served a 64 one, we may take a little time to do it, but we're going to get that 64 ounces down sooner or later. That's just human nature.
Well, you know, it's curious, because I do remember when Coca-Cola was 6.5 ounces, and I always, you know, I just accepted that. It never left me. I actually don't drink soda at all anymore, but I did when I was a kid, and it never left me feeling like I needed more. That was the serving, and the same is true with almost anything else. Cookies used to be a lot smaller. Bagels used to be a lot smaller, and they seem to be normal size. Now, when I look at them, they seem tiny.
Yeah, the mini bagel that you can sometimes buy in bagel shops is the size that bagels used to be when I was growing up. And the mini muffins are the size of muffins. And this is the work that Lisa Young did when she was a doctoral student. She went around and measured all of that. And it's very useful to have that historical information. But people who were born since 1980 never saw it any other way. So for them, these huge sizes are normal, and anything smaller looks like it's not enough to eat.
You do a lot of science in the book, and we haven't really talked a whole lot about that yet. I think I'm going to leave that for the listeners to go get your book and read it. It was fascinating. But some things I'd like to ask about. You know, I used to hear a lot about a set point of weight. Is that a real concept? If so, why have we just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger? How do we reconcile weight set points and the obesity epidemic?
Oh, it's not that hard to do the reconciliation. The set point idea came about from observations, and these were observations before the obesity problem started to get really serious. The observations were that people eat different amounts of foods every year, and yet weight stays stable. You eat about 1 million calories a year, and yet for somebody who's not gaining weight, weight stays the same over a very, very long period of time, and the body compensates for small differences in calories from one day to the next. Calorie intake on a daily basis varies enormously, and yet people stayed about the same weight. And so that gave rise to the idea of a set point, that there was a body weight that for people was at different levels, but it was kind of a place where there was an equilibrium, and if you started to gain weight, you would burn it off the extra calories. If you started to lose weight, you would take in more calories and stay roughly the same. We know much more about body weight regulation now, and we know that there are about 100 factors, physiological factors, that regulate hunger and satiety, and that these factors are much, much better at telling you when you need to eat more than they are at telling you when to stop. And, you know, the evolutionary theory about that is that food was scarce and it was really important for people to get food in order to maintain blood glucose levels at an appropriate level to get sugar to the brain, because that's what keeps the brain busy and active. And if the brain isn't getting enough fuel, then the body does everything it can to make sure that blood glucose levels are adequate to feed the brain. So the system was designed to do that. It was never designed to tell people who were eating too much food that it was absolutely time to stop. And so in an environment, starting in the 1980s, when the food environment changed so drastically, when people were confronted with a food environment in which portions were larger, food became available everywhere, and it became socially acceptable to eat at all times of day, frequent eating any place, any time, in very large portions. That did it. You don't need any more explanation than that, unless you want to go back, as we do in the book, and talk about what caused those kinds of changes in the early 1980s.
We're talking with Marion Nessel about why calories count, from science to politics. She co-wrote the book with Malden Nesheim.
Yeah, and that is a fascinating discussion you have in there. You really talk to what I'd call the political economic factors that cause this. And you start with agriculture, which seems a fitting place. Tell us about that.
Well, there were three things that happened in the early 1980s that I think led to the current food environment, which is so different than the one back then. Larger portions, food everywhere. The first thing was agricultural, the change in agricultural policy. Farmers used to be paid to keep their fields fallow and put their fields into conservation for years at a time, and they got subsidized for doing that starting in the mid-1970s or so. The agricultural policies changed to give more money to farmers who grew more food. So the idea was to just grow as much food as you possibly can, and the more you grew, the more money you would get from the government. Farmers are very good at that, and at the same time, farming became much more efficient. And the combination of efficiency and subsidies meant that the number of calories available in the food supply went up from 3,200 in 1980 to 3,900 by the year 2000. And that was the amount that was available. It wasn't what people were actually eating. But it meant that the food industry was very competitive. And the second thing that happened was a huge change in the way Wall Street evaluated corporations. Up until the early 1980s, Wall Street highly valued blue-chip stocks that gave long, slow returns on investment. You never hear about blue-chip stocks anymore. Now it's all about higher immediate returns on investment and growing profits every 90 days. And we see the results of that on Wall Street, but for food companies, it was especially difficult because they were already trying to sell food in an environment in which there were 3,900 calories a day available for every man, woman, and child in the country, twice as much probably as the country needed. And now they had to grow, and they couldn't just make a profit, they had to grow their profits every 90 days. And as a result of that, food companies started the whole business with food in larger portions because food is so cheap in this country, they could do that and make an enormous amount of money off of it. They began placing food everywhere. For people who live in New York City, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Just go into any drugstore in New York City, and it looks like a grocery store.
Or a bookstore, as you point out.
Yeah, or you go into a bookstore, and I like to ask the question, when did it become okay to eat in bookstores? I can remember when you weren't allowed to bring food or drink into a bookstore or libraries. The library at NYU, when I first came, used to have posters all over it saying how quickly you would be expelled if you brought food into the library. And there were pictures of cockroaches crawling over books and all that kind of thing. Now there are two cafes and loads of vending machines in our library.
Yeah, so let's go over this again, because I found that this was something that had never occurred to me. And yet it's so fundamental. You're saying that the whole short-termism of Wall Street, the need to declare on every quarter that you've not only increased your profits, but you've increased the rate at which you've made a profit, meant that those companies had to make sure that Americans were actually buying and eating those 3,900 calories a day.
They didn't care about the eating of it. They just wanted to sell more food.
Right.
That's all they were doing. They weren't trying to make Americans fat. Mm-hmm. They were just trying to sell more food in an environment in which there's far too much food available, and it's hugely competitive. And they were very good at it. They were very good at it. And the things that they did that I think made people eat more were making larger portions, putting food absolutely everywhere, clothing stores. Everywhere, and then making it socially acceptable for people to eat all day long in very, very large portions.
And market share was part of this as well, because they would be competing with other food suppliers to
sell
their food.
Doing exactly the same thing.
Right.
Yeah, for some kind of proportion of the market share of the 3,900 calories. Now, the 3,900 calories is not what people are eating. It's what's available, and the Department of Agriculture says 1,000 of those calories are wasted one way or another, but there's still an enormous surplus of food.
Marion Nessel says obesity rates skyrocketed in the 1980s.
The rarity stopped. In the early 1980s, rates of obesity went up very, very quickly between 1980 and 2000.
So people are eating more than those 2,000 calories.
No question about it. I mean, they either have to be eating more or moving less. And they may be doing both, but the evidence is much, much stronger for eating more than it is for moving less.
You also talk about starvation and malnutrition and food insecurity. Is there a connection between the obesity epidemic on the one hand and an epidemic of malnutrition and food insecurity on the other?
Yeah, and it has to do with the economics of inequality. The highest rates of undernutrition and of overnutrition occur among the poor in industrialized countries. In developing countries, there's a huge gap in income between the highest and the lowest earners, and the lack of an adequate calorie and food intake is responsible for hunger and malnutrition among about 1 billion people. In the world, it's more of a problem in developing countries than it is in the United States, where even poor people are overweight, where the highest rates of obesity are among the poor in this country. It's one of the great ironies.
And yet, we have tremendous food insecurity. And in fact, right now, the Farm Bill is being debated in the Congress. And there's been a lot of talk about cutting the food stamp program, currently known as SNAP. What's your take on what's going on there?
Well, I just know what I read in the papers. The Senate voted yesterday to not convert food stamps into block grants run by the state. So everybody breathed a huge sigh of relief about that. There are a whole bunch of amendments to the Farm Bill that tinker with the program is now called SNAP, that tinker with the SNAP program in one way or another, and we just don't know what's going to happen with them. And this is just the Senate bill that's being debated. The House hasn't even started on it yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read something today as we're doing this interview. I read something, a paper that's just come out, I believe, from Public Citizen, talking about here again that the SNAP program actually seems to benefit the Wall Street short-term profit guys more than it does poor Americans.
Yeah, no, that paper came from Michelle Simon, who's a consultant, and her paper analyzed who makes money off of SNAP benefits. I mean, one of the things that's really shocking, if you're not up on this kind of thing, is that the government paid $72 billion last year in SNAP benefits. About $6 billion a month goes out in to the recipients of what used to be called food stamps. And the average food stamp benefit is about $134 a month. But the amount of money that goes out on it is about 80% of the money that's in the farm bill. Most of it is food stamp money. And what this analysis looked at was who benefited from all of that. And it has interesting beneficiaries. J.P. Morgan, the bank, for example, runs the SNAP benefits in 24 states. So it's very much to J.P. Morgan's advantage to have lots of people on food stamps, because the more people who are on food stamps, the more money J.P. Morgan gets. And a lot of that money is spent in places like Walmart. And so Walmart gets a great deal of revenue. It's almost like a government subsidy from food stamp recipients. And they have to spend that $134 someplace. Spend it at Walmart where things are cheaper. So the beneficiaries of food stamps go beyond the poor people who get benefits. They also extend to banks, to the grocery stores that get more business because of it. And I suppose you could say they benefit the communities if any of that money stays in the community. But apparently it doesn't. It goes to corporations. The food stamp issue has become extraordinarily complicated because of high rates of obesity among the poor. Obviously, they're getting enough food not to starve to death, but the theories about why poor people are overweight and developing chronic diseases are big and complicated, and it's very difficult to know how to deal with it. But one idea is to try to change the food stamp program to put some limits on what people can buy with federally supported dollars. And those ideas are floating around. Whether anything will come up there in the farm bill, I have no idea.
So from a public health perspective, what do we need to do, whether it be with, you know, in the farm bill, in the food stamp program, what do we need to do to prevent obesity and to promote good nutrition?
Well, you need to promote an environment that fosters eating less, moving more, eating better. For example, one of the public health measures that I've advocated for a long time is having restaurants give a price break to people who order smaller portions. For example, I had lunch at a lovely restaurant today in which they produced a sandwich that was enough for two meals at least. And we had ordered salads with it. I mean, it was far too much food to eat. And yet, if they had said, for a lower price, we'll give you half a sandwich, I would have ordered half a sandwich.
Eating more healthy foods, like fruits and vegetables, are hard to do on a budget because they tend to be more expensive than junk food. I asked Marion Nessel what public policy measures could be taken to remedy that.
Well, that's the farm bill again. I mean, there's a great perception among poor people, especially, that fruits and vegetables are very expensive. And it turns out they are. If you look at the index price of fruits and vegetables since 1980, according to the Department of Commerce, the index price of fresh fruits and vegetables has gone up by 40% since 1980, whereas the index price of sodas and snack foods has gone down by 20 or 30%. Fruits and vegetables are relatively more expensive now than they were in 1980, before the obesity problem really got bad. So what is that about? Well, that's about agricultural subsidies that support corn, soybeans, and some other commodities, but were not available to fruits and, to the growers of fruits and vegetables. Some of the amendments and some of the provisions in the Farm Bill are to make the Farm Bill supports available to the growers of fruits and vegetables. That would be a big step forward in making them cheaper. And there are lots of pilot programs that are trying to make fruits and vegetables cheaper so that poor people can buy them. But overall, we need an agricultural policy that supports public health, not corporate health, or at least not so much corporate health.
And you do explain that and much, much more in this absolutely fascinating book, Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. I want to thank you so much, Marion Nessel, for speaking with us here on Writer's Voice. You wrote that book with your co-author, Malda Nesheim. Thank you.
It was my pleasure.
Marion Nessel teaches in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. Her blog is foodpolitics.com. In addition to Why Calories Count, she's the author of the book Food Politics and Feed Your Pet Right, among others. Next up, we hear my 2006 interview with food psychologist Brian Wanzink. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. There are many drivers of the obesity epidemic, but as we heard in the first segment of today's show, the calculus is easy. Too many calories going in and not enough being burned. The thing is, there's food everywhere, and portions tend to be supersized. How can we resist the temptation that lures us from all sides? Food psychologist Brian Wanzink has the answer. Back in 2006, we spoke with him about his book, Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. Here's an abridged version of that interview. Wanzink is the director of the Cornell Food and Brand Lab, which has a restaurant called The Spice Box. That's one of the places where the lab scientists test the eating behaviors of their subjects.
We might change the name or label on a wine and see how it influences how much of a meal people eat. We might change the lighting. We might have something unusual happen that throws people off to see how they respond in the way they eat. It enables us to test the very specific things that we think are almost invisible to most people, but which influence how much they eat or how much they like food.
Well, tell us some of those things. Like, for example, what happens when you change the label on a wine?
Okay. Well, we actually did do that in the Spice Box. What we did is we brought people in for a nice French prefix meal. And it was the middle of February and cold night. We said, hey, thanks for keeping your reservation. Because you kept the reservation, we'd like to offer you a complimentary glass of wine. And what we did was we had a very cheap bottle of $2 bottle of wine that we'd soaked the label off. And what we did is we put on fake labels, which said that it was either this Cabernet from California, a place known for wine, respected for wine, or we put on a label that said a Cabernet from North Dakota, not a place known for wine, not necessarily a place very well respected for wine. And we know from a prior study that when people end up drinking something that they believe is going to taste good, they do evaluate it as better. They essentially look for those good qualities and those good aspects, and their taste buds conveniently confirm their expectations. Well, in this case, we weren't interested in what the wine tastes like. We were interested in how it influenced the rest of the meal. And what we found, if people thought they're eating a California, drinking a California wine, they loved the food. They ate 10 minutes longer. They ate 11% more of the food. If they had one from North Dakota, it just wasn't as good. They just finished up dinner and left, and they left a lot more of their food in their plate.
So their expectations determined how they actually tasted or enjoyed the food.
You know, absolutely. But, I mean, you know, we've known this for a lot of studies we've done in cafeterias. We've gone to cafeterias and to restaurants, and we've changed the names of the menus. So, you know, 1 week the menu item would be called seafood filet, and the next week it would be called succulent Italian seafood filet. Well, in reality, it's just like a dried-up fish stick. But the people who eat the thing that they believe is a succulent Italian seafood filet, I mean, they rate the foods better, they rate the restaurant as better, and after they finish eating, they actually believe that the chef has had probably 1 to 2 years of culinary training overseas.
Now, you've mentioned two things. One was a $2 bottle of wine.
Yes, $2 chuck.
And the other is exactly $2 chuck. And the other was from a box of, I assume, frozen dried up fish sticks, right?
Yeah. So this is bad cafeteria seafood.
Yeah. So what is it that gets people to fool themselves that something tastes good that really doesn't taste that great?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, what's going on is we have so many things going on in our life that our life pretty much becomes filled with mindless eating because we parallel process things. We end up doing a lot of stuff at the same time. And eating can be a fairly automatic activity, as can the evaluation of food. So we're probably more interested in what our dinner mates are talking about or how work's going or something like that. So the evaluation of food becomes very peripheral. And when something's very peripheral, we end up being very easily influenced by the little cues around us, whether it be names and labels or whether it be packages and plates or whether it be music and lighting.
So your book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And you also talk about something called the mindless margin. What is that?
Well, what happens is that the majority of people who gain weight in a year gain it at less than 2 to 3 pounds a year. I mean, that's a difference of 25 calories. And 25 calories extra a day is really, you know, nothing more than about 5 M&Ms or about 8 Tic Tacs. So there's very few calories we eat in excess every day that lead us to gain weight. The mindless margin is the number of calories we can trim out of our day without noticing it physiologically, without noticing it psychologically, that can end up leading to weight loss. And we estimate that very, very, very conservatively to be as much as 300 calories. Meaning if we come up with three little changes that cut 300 calories out of our day, we're not going to miss it from a physiological or psychological standpoint. We're not going to have headaches. We're not going to have stomach growling. But over the course of a year, 300 extra calories, 300 less calories a day translates into 30 less pounds at the end of the year. And that's the mindless margin.
And we're talking with Brian Wanzink, and the book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. You know, I have to say, I was really astonished. I mean, the idea that one could lose 30 pounds almost effortlessly, or that's going to be the subject of most of what we talk about today, how you actually do that, really surprised me. Have you seen this work with people? I mean, do you know people that's worked with?
Yeah, actually, we know it actually works for most of the people in the lab. Most of the people start in the lab. We know what cues lead people to overeat, so we gradually find that people, you know, start doing the small things that our study suggests, and all of a sudden we find people losing quite a bit of weight very quickly. I mean, not very quickly, but over the course of the year, we'll find people will drop down to a low BMI very, very quickly.
You mean your colleagues?
Yeah, my colleagues. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow. So let's talk about some of those cues. I have to say, this is a hugely entertaining book. And I had to laugh out loud at some of the experiments that you did. One of them was the bottomless soup bowl.
Well, what happens is most people believe they're master and commander of all their food choices. I mean, they believe that they know when they're full. In reality, we have very little idea when we're full sometimes because we end up eating largely with our eyes instead of our stomach. I mean, at the extremes, we'd know we were full, but in the middle, we're not really that aware of being full. And if you were to ask most people, when are you through eating? Most people would say, I'm pretty much through eating when the plate's empty or when my bowl's empty. We thought we'd figure out what happens if the plate never empties. What happens if your bowl never empties? And we designed these refillable soup bowls. these bottomless soup bowls where we drilled holes in the bottom of bowls and we drilled holes through the table and connected using food grade tubing the bowl through the table over to a big 6-quart cauldron of soup. Now, in doing this, a person could theoretically eat 6 quarts of soup before they ever hit the bottom of the soup bowl, because as they eat, the level goes down, but then it slowly, slowly, slowly refills itself. And what we find is that when we bring people in for lunch and they eat away, we stop them after 20 minutes. But they've eaten 73% more soup in a refillable soup bowl than they did a normal one. Yet, when we ask them to rate how full they are, they don't rate themselves as being any more full. Because after all, I mean, they've only eaten half a bowl of soup. There's still a half a bowl left. How can they be full?
But they did say that the soup was good and filling.
Yeah, they did. They did like the taste of the soup, even though they ended up, you know, eating it ad nauseum.
You know, how do you guys think up these experiments? You know, I have this image that you all sit around a table and you do a lot of chuckling.
Oh, yeah, we do. We've got very funny people in the lab, and we've always, I mean, something you'd be attracted to something as non-traditional in academics as food psychology. That person's got to have a good sense of humor.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I decided I needed to go on a crash diet because I'm going to be going to an award ceremony. And actually, in all modesty, I'm going to be one of the people getting an award for a documentary I did last year. And I thought, oh, my God, now I have got to lose those extra 10 pounds. So I went on the Atkins diet. Mm-hmm. And within 3 days, I'd had enough.
Well, I mean, that's one thing about that deprivation diets is people can lose weight on them, but not mere mortals. Boy, I think the people who can really lose a lot of weight on these, it's got to become a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
I had the good fortune to work and write a number of things with Mike Huckabee, who's the governor of Arkansas, and who's ended up losing about 120 pounds in a year just through discipline and exercise. And so we know it can be done. But for most of us, most people don't want to lose 120 pounds. Most people would be happy. In fact, a recent study we did showed that most people, around 80%, would be happy if they lost 20 pounds or less,
mm-hmm.
Actually 18 pounds or less. And for 18 pounds or less, boy, going on a deprivation diet is just not going to cut it for most of us. It's a whole lot easier to just trim 100, 150 calories out of your day, and at the end of the year, you'll easily be 10 or 15 pounds less without even knowing you've been on a diet.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with food psychologist Brian Wansink about his book, Mindless Eating. You talked about the mindless margin, how we mm-hmm. mindlessly put on the weight. And, of course, that leads to also then, you know, setting things up in your life so that you mindlessly lose weight, I think, is kind of the point of your book.
Absolutely, yes.
I wanted to ask you, what are some of the major cues or major ways that people are mindless about food? I mean, you talked about, you know, that we're distracted a bit. I wonder if you could talk more about that and some of the other ways also that we set ourselves up for failing to lose weight.
Mm. Well, one thing is that we make over 200 food decisions a day. I mean, we think we make about 15. In reality, we make well over 200 food decisions a day. Even for breakfast, we're deciding which cereal to have, but how much to pour, whether to put skim milk or whole milk, whether to put sugar on it, whether to cut a banana. We make 15 decisions before we even have a bite to eat. But the thing is, we're not even aware of having made those. And so at every one of those points when we make a decision, whether it be how much milk to pour or how much cereal to pour, we can easily be influenced by a peripheral cue that suggests that we maybe pour a little bit more than we otherwise would have. The bowl size, for instance, will encourage us to pour more. The size of the container of milk is going to lead us to pour more. A huge cereal box will have us pour more. Mm-hmm. All these things have very subtle influences, but as we know, hey, very small influences that just lead us to eat 25 calories more lead us to gain 2.5 pounds over the course of a year. And so that's what we need to target at turning around.
Now, what would you do with that? You know, you got your Cheerios box. You got the economy size. So it's a big one.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Well, I mean, you know, one thing would be as simple as say, you know, buy a smaller box. But, you know, that's ridiculous for a lot of us because we want to buy the economy size because we save a lot of money. An easier thing to do would just be to simply use smaller bowls and put the box of cereal not on the table, but leave it on the counter. Hey, you can have seconds if you want to. But we find that simply having something 6 feet away, whether it be a candy dish or a cereal box or a bowl of pasta, leads people to end up eating less over the course of their meal because at some point you just don't mindlessly pour another bowl. You say, hey, do I really want some? And that 6 feet gives you pause to say, am I really hungry? And oftentimes, half the time, in some of our studies, the answer is no.
Half the time.
Yeah, we did a series of studies that were it was fun. It was with secretaries at a university, and this was when I was at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and we enlisted a number of secretaries in the study and gave them a month's worth of chocolates, these are Hershey Kisses, and put them. We either placed them on their desk, or we placed them just 6 feet from their desk, and every single night we went and refilled all these bowls, counting how many they'd eaten. And we found that the typical person with a bowl on their desk ended up eating about 9 of these Hershey Kisses every single day, which is about 225 calories. If it was moved just 6 feet off their desk, the exact same person would end up eating 4 candies, which is about 100 calories. So simply having it on her desk, if she did it every day for a year, she'd be 12 pounds heavier. But having it 6 feet, it was interesting when we did the debriefing and we talked to people and we say, is it that much of a hassle just to walk 2 steps? Is that why you ate so few candies when it was moved off your desk? They'd say, no, it's not that it's much of a hassle. It's just that that 6 feet gave me pause to ask myself, hey, am I really that hungry? Half the time they asked themselves that, they came up with the answer, no.
Right, and also it was out of their line of vision. You know, it's funny you said secretaries in the universities because I just noticed that every secretary I know has a bowl of candy on her desk.
No, we call them social magnets. When we'll talk to people that are perpetually dieting, they'll say, hey, why do you have that bowl on your desk? You know what's going to happen. They go, yeah, but you know, it's a conversation piece. People come by, they'll stop by, they'll talk. I make people smile when they stop by. Well, hey, we've got about 400 candy dishes in our lab because that's basically, you know, a lot of that in the food lab. People stop by expecting to have food. But what we've done is we just replaced all the candy we like with candy we don't like. So instead of having the chocolates and things, we've replaced it with sweet and sour candies like, you know, sweet tarts and things like that, which we don't like quite so much. Hey, they're no temptation for us, but people still stop by.
And you mentioned portion, you know, the size of the bowl. What about the size of the food, the size of the portions? I mean, what's happened to these over the last, you know, in the last 30 years?
Oh, well, the same thing has happened to our kitchens. They've gotten bigger and bigger and bigger because why? Well, because we can afford it, because we're a country with a lot of space. And so we're always looking for value. And the first time that a restaurant decides to increase the size of its fries by 25%, its competitors have a choice. They can either increase the size of their fries 25% and be seen as an equal bargain, or they can keep them where they're at and be seen as expensive. So what we have is sort of an escalation of competition among restaurants.
Yeah, you know, it's always very frustrating to me because even around here, which is kind of, you know, you live in Ithaca, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Well, this is kind of the alternative Ithaca here.
Yeah, exactly.
In the Pioneer Valley. And there are a lot of really wonderful little cafes that have, you know, a lot of good healthy food in them, but the size of their cookies, my goodness, are the size of dinner plates. You know, and when you ask, do you have anything that's smaller? No, they don't.
You know, why would we have that? That's right. Well, you know, one of the real dangers that goes on in some of these places is a health halo, too, that you can have a very wonderful restaurant that makes very healthy food, but there's a tendency that we fall into, and this is a tendency of applying this health halo to, first of all, everything that a restaurant like that makes, but second of all, what it leads us to do is to compensate. We call it compensating behavior. So, for instance, we find when people eat what they consider to be a relatively healthy lunch, they're more likely to order chips and order cookies than when they eat something that they know is otherwise fairly indulgent. So in one study, we call the McSubway study, we found that people who ate, we intercepted people as they left either Subways or McDonald's that were within half a block of each other. And we found that the people leaving McDonald's, of course, they ate more food and they ate more calories. They ate about 1,000 calories, but they estimated that they ate about 900. The people leaving Subway ate less calories. They ate about 700 calories, but they estimated they ate about 400. Because what happened? Hey, they believed everything they ate there was healthy, but that didn't include the cheese. It didn't include the mayonnaise. It didn't include the chips, and it didn't include the cookies they ordered.
And they didn't know how many. You said people consistently underestimate the amount of calories that they take in.
Every single one of us underestimates the number of calories we take in by an average of 20%. Mm-hmm. But that's those who are of normal weight. If somebody's heavy, they underestimate it by closer to 40 or 50%.
Why is that?
Well, it's interesting. In the past, clinicians have treated this, when they've treated a heavy person that's come in for diet counseling, they often say, well, you are underreporting what you eat because either you don't have the knowledge to know what you're eating, you know, you're ignorant, or because you're lying to yourself or you're lying to us. And holy cow, that would be the end of the counseling session as far as I'd be concerned if, you know, if somebody would treat you that way. What we found in studies that happens is that regardless of whether a person is popsicle skinny or heavy, everybody underestimates the size of a very, very large meal. Okay, let's say, for instance, it's a 2,000-calorie Thanksgiving dinner. The heavy person and the skinny person alike are going to estimate the same dinner as being about 1,000 calories. And it has nothing to do with their weight. It's just that really huge meals tend to be underestimated in a mathematical, predictable way by everybody. The problem is that heavy people just eat a lot more 2,000-calorie meals than the skinny person.
We're talking with Brian Wansink about his book, Mindless Eating. Brian Wansink says there are a lot of things you can do to adjust your eating environment so it becomes almost mindless to lose weight. Things like, so you mentioned, for example, putting the high-carb or the sugar items on another counter. So there's some mindfulness there. You also talk about something that, you know, I'm very attached to, and that is, you know, when I eat alone, I'm reading or listening to the radio or both.
Or on the computer even sometimes. Oh,
exactly. That's the other thing. Eating, you talk about desktop dining. So you talk about applying mindfulness to be able to mindlessly lose some weight.
And the idea about mindfulness is once you know what's leading you to eat 50, 75, 100 more calories of the mashed potatoes you just had or the dessert you just had, once you know what does that, just turning that around so it works for you and just do that habitually, it works real well. So we find that people who have the habit of meal stuffing, which is overeating meals a lot, one reason this occurs is because they're very fast eaters. They'll start eating, and they'll continue to eat until everybody at the table is through eating. It means taking seconds of this, thirds of that, seconds of this. And before you know it, they've consumed an immense number of calories just simply because they're waiting for other people to finish. Now, with these people, we'll videotape the dinners, and the next day we'll say, hey, how many helpings did you have last night of mashed potatoes? And they'll go, No, I think I had two. And you'll show them the videotape, and you'll say, would you believe four? Because the problem is they just mindlessly refill their plate. Doing something as simple as moving those heavy dishes, the starches and the foods, off the table just a few feet, whether it be back in the stove or whether it be a sideboard or whether it be a counter, I will guarantee we'll cut 30% of the calories out of most meal stuffers' dinners.
That was Brian Wansink. I spoke with him in 2006 about his book, Mindless Eating. He teaches and researches the psychology of food at Cornell University. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.